all of them nicely drivable. My father takes special note of these roads as he walks because, more than anything else, this is what my father loves to do. Drive. Past things. To get in cars and drive down roads all over the country, all over the world. To drive just as slowly as the law will allow. Although the law, especially as it pertains to speed limits, is not something Edward Bloom respects. 20 in town is too fast for him. The highways are madness. How can the world be seen at such speeds? Where do people need to go so badly they can't realize what is already here, outside the car window? My father remembers when there were no cars at all. He remembers when people used to walk, and he does too, walk, that is, but he still loves the feeling of an engine rumbling, wheels rolling, the display of life framed in the windows in front and back and on all sides. The car is my father's magic carpet. Not only does it get him places, but it shows him places. A car he drives is driven so slowly and takes so long to get from here to there that some of his important business deals are done in cars. Those who have appointments with him follow this procedure. They find out where he is on this or that day and figure that, being such a slow driver, he'll remain in the general vicinity for most of the rest of the week. Then they fly to the closest airport and rent a car. From there, they hit the road and drive until they catch up with him. They'll drive up beside his car and honk and wave, and my father will slowly turn, the way Abraham Lincoln would have slowly turned if Lincoln had ever driven a car. Because in my mind, in the memory that has lodged itself imperturbably in my mind, my father resembles Abraham Lincoln. A man with long arms and deep pockets and dark eyes. And he waves back and pulls over, and whoever needs to speak to him gets in on the passenger side, and this person's deputies or lawyers will get in the back, and as they continue to drive along these beautiful wandering roads, their business is done. And who knows? Maybe he even has affairs in these cars, romances with beautiful women, famous actresses. At night, a small table is set between them, covered in a white tablecloth, and by candlelight, they eat and drink and make frivolous toasts to the future. In Spectre, my father walks. It happens to be a nice fall day. He smiles at everything and everyone gently, and everything and everyone smiles gently back. He walks with his hands clasped behind him, peering with a friendly gaze into storefronts and alleyways, and already by this time, somewhat sensitive to the sun's light, squinting, therefore, which only makes him seem friendlier and more delicate, which he is. He is friendlier and certainly more delicate than he seems ever to anyone. And he falls in love with this town, with its marvelous simplicity, its unadorned charm. The people who greet him, who sell him a Coke, who wave to him and smile at him from their cool porches as he passes. My father decides to buy this town. Spectre has that special somber quality, he says to himself, a quality not unlike living underwater that he can appreciate. It's a sad place, actually, and has been for years since the railroad was shut down or the coal mines dried up, or the way it seems that Spectre has just been forgotten. That the world has passed it by. And though Spectre didn't have much use for the world anymore, it would have been nice to be a part of it, to have been invited. This is the quality my father falls in love with, and this is the reason he makes the town his own. The first thing he does is to purchase all the land surrounding Spectre as a kind of buffer, in case some other rich, suddenly lonely man stumbles upon the town and wants to build a highway through it. He doesn't even look at the land. He only knows that it's green with pine and that he wants to keep it that way. Wants what is, in effect, a self-enclosed ecosystem. And he gets it. No one knows one man is buying the hundreds of tiny parcels that are up for sale, just as no one knows it when every house and store in town is bought, one by one, over a period of about 5 or 6 years, by someone other than anybody somebody else knows. Not for a while, anyway. There are people who are moving, and there are businesses that are closing, and these are not difficult to purchase at all. But to those who like things fine just as they are and who want to stay in one place, a letter is sent. The letter offers to buy their property and everything on it for a handsome price. They're not asked to leave, to pay rent, or to change anything but the name in which the house and store, every store, is owned. And in just this way, slowly but quite surely, my father buys Spectre, every square inch of it. I imagine him quite pleased with the transaction, for, true to his word, nothing changes. Nothing but the sudden and suddenly routine appearance in town of my father, Edward Bloom. He doesn't call in advance, for I don't believe even he knows when he's going to make it back. But one day he'll be seen by somebody. He's the lone figure standing out in the fields, or the one walking down 9th Street with his hands deep in his pockets. He walks through the stores he now owns and breaks a dollar or two. But he leaves the management of these stores to the men and women of Spectre, of whom he will ask in his soft, grandfatherly voice, "Well, now, how are things? And how is your wife, the kids?" He clearly loves the town so much and all of the people in it, and they love him back because it is impossible not to love my father. Impossible. This, anyway, is what I imagine. It is impossible not to love my father. "Fine, Mr. Bloom, everything's just fine. We had a good month last month. Would you like to see the books?" But he shakes his head no. "I'm sure you have everything well under control here. Just stopped in to say hello. Well, I've got to go now. Goodbye. Say hello to your wife for me, would you?" And when the high school boys of Spectre play baseball against other teams from other schools, he might be seen, his tall, dark gauntness, alone in the stands in his three-piece suit, watching the proceedings with the proud, detached quality with which he watched me grow. Each time he comes to Spectre, he stays with a different family. No one knows who it will be or when, but there is always a room ready for him when he asks, and he always asks, as though it will be as a favor to a stranger. "Please, if it wouldn't be too much trouble." And he will eat with the family and sleep in the room and in the morning be on his way. And he always makes his bed. "I reckon Mr. Bloom will have himself a soda on a day as hot as this one," Al says to him one day. "Let me get one for you, Mr. Bloom." "Well, thank you, Al," my father says. "That will be fine, actually. A soda will be fine." He sits on a bench in front of Al's country store, doing nothing. Al's country store. He smiles at the name and tries to cool down in the shade beneath the overhang. Just the tips of his black shoes jut out into the bright sunlight of this summer's day. Al brings him the soda. Another man named Wiley is there. And this old man chews on the end of a pencil and stares at my father as he drinks. Wiley had been the sheriff inspector for a while, then the pastor. After being the pastor, he became the grocer. But by this time, talking to my father in front of Al's country store, he does nothing at all. He's retired from everything but talking. Wiley says, "Mr. Bloom, I know I've said it before, I know I have, but I will say it again. It is great what you've done with this town." My father smiles.
"I haven't done anything with this town, Wiley."
"That's just it,"
Wiley says and laughs. And Al laughs, and my father laughs too.
"We think that's great."
"How's that soda, Mr. Bloom?"
"Refreshing," my father says. "It's quite refreshing, Al. Thank you."
Wiley has a farm a mile out of town. It's one of the first worthless things my father ever bought.
"I have to say what Wiley says," Al says. "Not every man could come and buy a whole town for the love of it."
My father's eyes are almost closed. It won't be long now before he can't go outside without powerful sunglasses on. His eyes become so sensitive to the light. But he can accept these good words with grace.
"Well, thank you, Al," he says. "When I saw Spectre, I knew I had to have it. I don't know why, except to say it's so. I had to have it all. I suppose, in part, it has to do with circles, with entireties. It's very difficult for a man such as myself to settle for a piece of something. If part of something is good, the whole of it can only be better. And as far as Spectre is concerned, this is certainly the case. To have it all...
But you don't,
Wiley says, still chewing on his pencil. His eyes move from Al to my father.
Wiley, Al says. Well, it's the truth, he says. Can't be wrong to say it if it's so.
My father turns to Wiley slowly, because my father has this special talent. Just by looking at a man, he can tell what the man's motivation is in saying a thing, whether or not he's honest or true or trying for more than is right. It's a kind of power, and it's one of the reasons he became so rich. And he can tell that Wiley thinks he is telling the truth.
Well, that can't be, Wiley, he says. That is, not as far as I know. I've been over every inch of this town, either on foot or in my car or seen it from the air, and I feel sure I've purchased it all, in its entirety. The whole kit and caboodle. It's a perfect circle.
Fine, then, Wiley says. I won't bring up that patch of ground with the shack on it between where the road stops and the lake starts that just might be hard to find by foot or car or to see from the air, and just might not be on any map, or how whoever owns it has a piece of paper you've never seen to sign, Mr. Bloom, because you and Al have all the truth with you over there. Don't know what I'm talking about, I guess. My apologies to you who knows better.
Wiley is kind enough to tell my father how to get there, how the road seems to end where it doesn't, and how the lake seems to be where it isn't, and how hard it would be for anybody to think to find this strange place, a swamp. A shack in a swamp. And so my father drives until the road seems to end, but when he gets out of his car, it's clear that beyond the trees and vines and dirt and grass, the road is there. The road goes on. It's been reclaimed by nature. By the lake now, too high for its own banks. In 3 inches of swamp water is more stagnant life than an ocean could hold. At its edge, where the muck hardens and warms, life itself begins. He walks into it. The swamp swallows up my father's shoes. He keeps walking. The water rises. The ooze clings to his trousers as he sinks. It feels good. He keeps walking. No trouble seeing in the dim light. And all of a sudden, there is a house ahead. A house. He can't believe that such a thing remains upright, that any weight will not be taken down in this soft earth. But there it is. Not a shack at all, but a real home. Small, but clearly well built, with 4 good sides and smoke coming out of a chimney. As he approaches, the waters draw back. The ground hardens. A path is there for him to follow. And he thinks, smiling, how clever and how lifelike. A path is provided at the very last moment, when one needs it least. On one side of the house is a garden, and on the other, there are wood piles as tall as he is himself. In a window box, a row of yellow flowers. He makes his way to the door and knocks.
Hello, he calls out. Is anybody home?
Sure,
a young woman's voice calls back.
May I come in?
There's a pause and then,
wipe your feet on the mat.
My father does just that. He pushes the door gently open and stands there, looking around at what is an impossible cleanliness and order. In the middle of the blackest backwater he has ever seen, he is staring at a warm, clean, comfortable room. He sees the fire first, but quickly looks away. From there he glances at the mantel on which there are a number of blue glass jars arranged in pairs, and from there he looks to the walls, which are nearly bare. There's a small couch, 2 chairs, and a brown hearth rug. In the doorway leading to another room,
stands the girl. She has long black hair braided in the back and still blue eyes. She can't be more than 20. Living in this swamp, he would have expected her to be as covered in grime as he is now. But other than a streak of black ash across one side of her neck, her white skin and her cotton calico dress could scarcely be cleaner.
"Edward Bloom," she says. "You are Ed Bloom, aren't you?"
"Yes," he says. "How did you know?"
"Figured," she says. "I mean, who else?"
He nods and says that he's sorry to bother her and her family, but that he has come on business. He tells her he would like to speak to the owner of the house here, her father, mother, and of the land the house is on. She tells him he is doing just that.
"I'm sorry."
"This is mine," she says.
"You," he says, "but you're just a..."
"Woman," she says, "near about."
"I'm sorry," my father says. "I don't mean..."
"Business, Mr. Bloom," she says, faintly smiling. "You said something about some business?"
"Oh, yes," he says.
And he tells her everything he knows. How he came to Spectre, how he fell in love with it, and how he merely wants to have it all. Call it a flaw in his nature, if you will, but he wants it, all of it. And this apparently is a piece of land he had overlooked, and he would like to buy it from her if she wouldn't mind, that nothing will change, she can stay here forever if she likes. He only wishes to call this town his own. And she says,
"Now, let me get this straight. You'll buy this swamp from me, but I'll stay in it. You'll own the house, but it'll still be mine. I'll be here, and you'll come and go as you please to one place or another because there's a flaw in your nature. Do I have that right?"
And when he tells her that she does, that in so many words she has it right, she says,
"Then I don't think so, Mr. Bloom. If nothing is going to change, I'd just as soon they not change the way things haven't been changing all this time."
"But you don't understand," he says. "In essence, you will lose nothing. Everybody actually gains by this, don't you see? You can ask anybody, Inspector. I have been nothing if not beneficent in every way. The people of Spectre have profited by my presence here."
"Let them profit," she says.
"It's a small thing, really. I wish you'd reconsider."
He's about to lose his temper or break down in sadness.
"I only want the best for everybody."
"Especially you," she says.
"For everybody," he says, "including me."
She stares at my father for a long time and shakes her head, her blue eyes still and steady.
"I don't have any folks, Mr. Bloom," she says. "They've been gone a long time."
She gives him a cold, mean stare.
"I've been fine here. I know things. Well, you might be surprised at all I know. It's not like some big check is going to change anything for me. Money, I just don't need it. I don't need anything, Mr. Bloom. I'm happy the way things are."
"Young woman," my father asks, incredulous, "what is your name?"
"Jenny," she says,
in a softer voice than the one she has been using till now.
"My name is Jenny Hill."
The story goes like this. He falls in love with Spectre first. Then he falls in love with Jenny Hill. Love is strange. What makes a woman like Jenny Hill suddenly decide my father is the man for her? What does he do to her? Is it that fabled charm? Or are Jenny Hill and Edward Bloom somehow made for each other? Did my father wait 40 years and Jenny Hill 20 to finally find the loves of their lives? I don't know. On his shoulders, he brings Jenny out of the swamp, and they drive to town together in his car. He drives so slowly at times that it's quite possible to walk beside his car at a good pace and talk to him, or, as it happens today, for all of Spectre to line the sidewalks to see what he has with him.